This is Body Talk, where we explore your inner universe.
Hi, everybody. David Lasondak here, author, structural integrator, and fascia specialist at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center's Center for Integrative Medicine. And today, I could not be happier to have as my guest, you know him, you love him, Robert Schleip, and he's going to be giving us an update on all the fascia goings on at the recent Fascia Winter School at Padua University in Italy. And of course, that's where Carlo Stecco and Caterina Feda hang their hats, along with Carmelo and all the other really fine people in the fascia research department there. So not much of a hard sell this week. Let's just get right into the conversation with the one and only Robert Schleip. All right, but let's talk about what happened in Italy. And it sounds like you've got some bigger news than that too, if I'm not mistaken.
What do you mean with?
Oh, didn't you say there was something you had to prepare and you could use more time, or was that not?
No, that was just the whole event was so positively overwhelming that everybody, including me, felt like I need some time to sort this out and go through my notes.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Okay, so the whole part of our winter school is a delight. And it is also a improvement on the summer schools that we had in Ulm University. I think we had them four times in 2 years distance, mm-hmm. and everybody enjoyed it. And Carla actually came to me at one of the last summer schools and said, Robert, I like this format. So it's a five-day event. People go to a university. Most of the participants are not students. They are established acupuncturists, fascia gurus, clinicians mostly. Mm-hmm. So they come and go to university for 5 days. And they come from all over the world to study and share their excitement and questions about what's new in fascia research and what they can take into their clinical applications. And then in the mornings, usually you have more theoretical lectures. In the afternoon, but there is some flexibility on that, you have a practical, more oriented groups that are changing. And the biggest practical group is the pro section. So that takes up most of the practical time. And that is what Carla had been doing at our summer schools. And also André Fleming, mm-hmm. and they are basically doing the same format. So you have the hands-on cadaver-oriented fascia dissection, where they are dissecting in front of you, and you get to see and touch and feel, and they show you exactly each layer, etc. And that is a big portion. And of course, every summer school there is new insights. And what I liked very much is this family feeling. And they continued that even more with their Italian hospitality than we had at Ulm University. And I had the very pleasant role to be not the circus director anymore. I was a relaxed participant, with the other participants. And they had been anxious to organize all the different circus activities for the rotating groups, etc., in the morning. So the whole thing is kind of a in the spirit of networking, and that worked so well. So many people came for the second time or for the third time, and they were eagerly looking forward to see each other, but also to see new people, and then to hear what is new. And I can share so what was new for
let's
me.
Let's dive into what's new.
Yeah. So they had much more focus on the superficial fascia, and they used the term in both ways. They use the term superficial fascia, everything between the dermis and the deep fascia underneath. And sometimes, so this whole subcutaneous connective tissue, but mostly they mean the membranous layer within the subcutaneous connective tissue. And that is what Carla most often calls superficial fascia. So the membranous layer.
So the superficial fascial membrane, so to speak.
Yeah.
I saw that for the first time actually in an Anatomyscapes Prosection.
Oh, good. Yeah.
And it's like,
yeah.
Oh, this is what they're talking about. It was because you don't get that in a preserved specimen. Yeah. You don't find that layer.
Yeah. Well, of course, they show the most nicest ultrasound images, and they're usually in the trunk, and there you see mm-hmm. exactly here is the dermis, here is the sat, superficial adipose tissue, mm-hmm. and then you have one single membrane of the membranous layer called superficial fascia, and then you have the deep adipose layer, and it looks beautiful if you see that there. But if you go 2 centimeters to the right and to the left, it doesn't look like that. And of course, that's not what they use in their teaching. But I think it's fair to say that seems to be an organizing principle, mostly in the trunk. And in adipose tissue, people, you have more than one membranous layer. And in the limbs, you don't have the membranous layer as a unified thing. And then, of course, you can discuss, are the limbs the non-true body and the trunk is the true body? Some people have more surface area in the limbs if they have long appendices, and some people have short appendices. Mm-hmm. So I think it's an arbitrary question, which one is the true body? It is a helpful analysis if you are looking at the back, if you're looking at the abdomen. Mm-hmm. And what they found out is that actually, the subcutaneous connective tissue, so the more superficial layers, they seem to be more dynamic and more interesting and maybe more therapeutically involved in what we do, but also how pathologies change us. So they found out that you have more innervation in the superficial, in the subcutaneous connective tissue mm-hmm. than in the deeper ones. You have more blood vessels in them. So you have a more dynamic regulation, you could say. Mm-hmm. You have more elastin fibers, 10 times more elastin fibers than in the deep fascia. And you also have a much higher degree. So the lymph flow seems to be very intimately linked with the subcutaneous connective tissue. You don't have many lymph vessels in the deep fascia,
no,
of course.
No, I don't think you would, yeah.
Yeah. So we had one or two good lectures on lymphatics this year. And so it seems like the lymphatic system, it has its nodules, mostly in the membranous layer, in the superficial fascia. And then it has stronger vessels in the DAT, in the deep adipose tissue. And it has thinner vessels who are more vertical in the superficial adipose tissue. So I think lymph flow, if it's impeded, it has a lot to do with the superficial adipose tissue there. And they also had found that it has a very high autonomic innervation. And I think this is very exciting.
Higher than expected?
Yeah, yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. So I think it's the same as they found in the deep adipose tissue. But the deep adipose tissue overall doesn't have much innervation. And in both of them, they had found it's about 30 or 40% of all nerves which are autonomic. That means it's the most potent single contributor. Mm. So you don't find any other sensory innervation type, whether it's the Golgi's or Ruffini's or the nociceptive endings, etc., which can compete with the sympathetic innervation. And that makes the biggest proportion in the deep fascia, but there overall it's not much. So the 30 or 40% make up a huge number per cubic millimeter in the superficial fascia. And that means that probably chronic emotional stress has a much more potent direct influence on the superficial fascia than it may have on the deep fascia.
Is there do we know if there's a difference in the turnover rate between the superficial fascia and the deep fascia in terms of the collagen turnover cycle.
Yeah. That was the other thing. There is also a higher vascularization. So there is a higher density of blood vessels in the subcutaneous connective tissue in the superficial fascial layers than in the deep one. And that usually goes together with a higher turnover rate. I know, for example, that the Achilles tendon has the lowest matrix remodeling rate, that it takes sometimes 100 years to replace a collagen fiber bundle in the Achilles tendon. so once you are outgrown, you keep the same collagen type 1 fiber bundles in your Achilles tendon. And that goes together, and that seems to be not by accident, that it's also the tendon that has the least density of blood vessels in it. So it means probably if you have active cells, then they need some nutrients. And if you basically have fibers and not much living cells, then you have only very tiny blood vessels. So based on that, I would say yes. So based on that synchrony, the more cellular metabolism you have, the more turnover rate you have, and that seems to go together with the density of vascularization. Yeah.
Okay. So what else is new?
The mast cells were new for me. I thought I know my family pretty well. You know, they are the fibroblasts. They are the newly discovered fasciocytes that I think should have been called the stecocytes. And then the telocytes, and then my beloved myofibroblasts. And there's my fascia family. But now, they emphasized the mast cells, which are basically immune cells.
Right.
And they come, I think, via the blood vessels into the tissue. And they are regularly in the connective tissue, in fascia. And they are basically influencing interaction with the immune system. And I used to think they only are there to in allergies, if you have an allergic reaction or if you have a histamine response, etc. No, they seem to be responsible to regulate pro and anti-inflammatory regulation cycles. So in wound healing, we know that the mast cells come into the tissue in order to say, now stage one of wound regulation, pro-inflammatory cytokines, day one, you know. And then on day 6 and 7, they say, pro-collagen fibers and break down and inhibit the inflammation. So we know they are the directors. And you have different mast cells. So they can be pro-inflammatory and they can be anti-inflammatory. But they found them in non-injured and in non-allergically affected fascia. So they seem to be a basic feature of fascia regulation, how it responds in terms of biochemistry, but maybe also in terms of fibrosis regulation. Yeah, so I think we need to embrace the mast cells.
I've had a number of patients over the years with mast cell activation syndromes. And it's, I don't know enough about how that can be affected positively or negatively by manual therapy, but it's certainly something that I've seen in small numbers, but nonetheless on the rise over the last 5 to 6 years. Yeah. Do you have any thoughts about that?
No, but more and more of my friends are planning or already doing to include mast cell analysis in their research. So, and then they want to find out, so which type of mast cells is it in kind of stretching protocols or in sports-related emphasis. So it's a new hot topic. Yeah. So for me, that was an eye opener, and the family is now larger of what you include. Another feature before I forget it, it was Carmelo reporting.
Yes.
But I think it, at first I thought, wow, he is a pioneer. But then he acknowledged that it was Kalla who had pushed him to not only do his ultrasound, where he is a world leader, but to look at what they call the myofascial junctions, and that is now a new term. So we know, and there is a lot of knowledge on how the architecture of the myotendinous junctions are. Mm-hmm. So when muscle fibers stop being a muscle fiber and migrate and merge with the tendon fibers in a linear force transmission. And that is the standard model all over sports medicine, how the force is transmitted from muscle fiber to tendon to the skeleton.
Mm-hmm. Very linear.
Yeah, so that's the normal model. And now more and more people and everybody in the fascia group knows that, acknowledge that maybe a third of the force or whatever, a significant amount of force, depending on the muscle and the region, does not go from the contractile muscle fibers via the tendon into the bone, but it goes in more broad directions, maybe to the neighboring muscle. So he looked with histological examination how the muscle fibers transmitting or how they are architecturally linked with the epimysium.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is there a little bundle there? So how is that done in a microscopic analysis? And he found similar, like in the myotendinous junction, you have the epimysium, like the bone here, and you have the muscle fibers, and in between you have an intermediate zone.
Uh-huh.
And that intermediate zone seems to have an angle of around 40 degrees, sometimes 35 degrees, sometimes 45 degrees. And that is the same whether it's from the fascia in the lower back or in the thigh or in the buttock. So they had these three areas in 12 cadavers and in 12 rats, or was it mice? Yeah, 12 each. So it's not a huge study, but it's the first study in the history of anatomy that somebody is trying to look at the architecture. How are contractile muscle fibers transmitting the force when they transmit it to the epimysium, and then the epimysium mm-hmm. may be attached to another epimysium on the next muscle?
So it's at a 40 degree angle. Is
yeah.
What's the orientation? Is it going 40 degrees more at an angle up towards the upper body, towards the lower body, from superficial to deep?
So the 40 degrees is probably mm-hmm. the smaller angle. So on the other side, you would have then. So what's 180 degrees minus 40 is, help me
140.
Out. 140. Yeah, so 140, yeah. So you have the epimysium as a horizontal line here, mm-hmm. and then you have a fiber coming not at 90 degrees,
but at 40 but also degrees not, from underneath.
But not at 45. Mm-hmm. And the shorter angle they describe as 40 degrees.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. But it was surprising. That seems to be an organizing principle in different species and in different body regions.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought this is very interesting.
So yeah, so they found the same angle in different parts of the body in the same body.
And,
wow.
And yeah, so... and. So this is a new area also to look at. And of course, they described what had been shown by Jaap van der Waal before, by Kalla Stecko, that you have more force transmission to the epimysium at the proximal regions of the lower arm, for example. So if you do dissection and mm-hmm. you have the epimysium, it's very difficult to peel it off because it's very adherently connected with the muscle fibers in the proximal region of the lower arm. On the distal region, the epimysium is more like an envelope that you can easily peel off from the muscle fibers underneath. So that seems to be an organizing principle. And I think that that may have clinical implications, how you work on the proximal lower arm as opposed to the lower arm. Don't tell me exactly how my roughing angle should be changing. Maybe somebody.
I don't work the upper and lower arm similarly, but don't really think about how it. I don't really think about how my application changes, but I can tell you that it does.
Yeah. Yeah, but maybe to answer the question that I said I don't have an answer, it could mean if I work on the proximal end of the lower arm, so close to the elbow, that if I push with my fingers at a diagonal angle, not vertically down, where I take the skin in a shearing direction, that I would expect that this would have a more immediate sticking effect on the muscle fibers underneath. Whereas if I do it close to the retinaculum, I would think I have more sliding ability and that it would not transmit so easily to the inside of the muscle. So if you take this, you always push the skin.
Right.
But your skin pushing would have an easier time to transmit the force you're doing or the stimulation inside of the muscle meat if you do that close to the elbow. And if you do it close to the wrist, you would have to work more vertically if you wanted to go deeper. So if you want to go deeper, you can do it easily at a 45-degree or similar angle. If you work close to the elbow, if you wanted to go deeper, for whatever reason, close to the wrist, you would have to work more vertically because it wouldn't push so easily. If you go in a sliding direction, it wouldn't grip the muscle fiber so easily, and you would slip outside of the muscle fiber. So that could be a possible application.
Okay, so I think everybody listening right now is going to take this back to their treatment room the day after they hear this. So thank you for that. I know I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that. So what else fired up your imagination?
A very nice thing is they shared a few things that they haven't published yet. Oh. And where they haven't done the final statistics yet. But then I think, I'm watching history unfold. They got a big grant from the Lipedema Foundation. And you know how this happened? Your friend Sue Hitzman.
Oh, okay.
She had told, that is the anecdotal, so please correct me if I'm making up fancy, fancy dreams, but I'm having joy with it. So Sue Hitzman, apparently, I heard it through the grapevine. She had told Kala, oh, by the way, if you want funding, there is an, I have friends here, and they are looking for new solutions. So it's not lymphedema, it's a lipedema.
Right.
That, so that we hear that it has been around since history, etc. And they have lots of pain and it's not that they are overeating, etc. And nobody really has a clear explanation and a satisfying solution so far. And they are despaired and they are collecting money. Let's see if we find new avenues. So Carla applied for it and she got the grant.
Wonderful.
And that is really nice because if you apply for a regular scientific grant, you have at least 99 competitors who are as good as you are, you know, and you write day and night. And then your friend gets the deal, etc. So she got the funding. And they started already to look at fascial properties. And they found that in lipedema, apparently, they haven't done the final statistics, but they saw convincing indications that you have more fibrosis in the superficial membranous layer of the subcutaneous connective tissue.
Mm-hmm.
And also more pro-inflammatory cytokines in there.
That makes sense.
So if that gets consolidated, that would mean, wow, fascia plays a big role there, you know. And then also that seems to be for me, as a structural integrator, where I think if you work deeper, you have more long-lasting effect than somebody who does superficial. And you American people, you are also superficial, and we Americans, we are deep. Mm-hmm. So if you say, Robert, you are my friend, etc., and then next day you say, I don't know you anymore, then I say, these are the superficial American people. And if I go in a Bavarian pub, they don't greet me for the first 3 years. And then in the fourth year, they say, you have a beer, you are my friend. And that means you can count on them for the next 30 years. So I'm just making a joke of my preference for depths.
Yes. So what you're going to say is deep down or shallow. That's what you're going to say.
Yeah, exactly. So, but it seems to be that the less deep work may have more profound effects.
Well, that's been a trend that's been slowly evolving over the last half a dozen years. Yeah, yeah.
So that could be also in relationship to lipedema. And they also dropped it in between the lectures, which is often where the real pearls start falling down into my ears, that also for fibromyalgia, they haven't gotten yet a $1 million grant for fibromyalgia research, but they also found indications that in fibromyalgia, you would have pro-inflammatory markers and fibrosis similar in the membranous layer. Mm. And so that would be interesting because I knew, and I shared with Color on that, in fibromyalgia, you have a dysregulation of the sympathetic innervation in the subcutaneous connective tissue in relationship to blood flow regulation. So the sympathetic nerve endings that are terminating near blood vessels, which is the majority, they are dramatically down in fibromyalgia patients. And that explains their temperature regulation problems. If they have cold feet, they complain longer around it. And if the room is too hot, they cannot think for the next half an hour. And so their temperature resilience is less strong than in non-fibromyalgia patients. And also, if they do cold showers, etc., they hate it, but they 2/3 of them say it also improved my fibromyalgia symptoms. Hmm. So microcirculation and temperature regulation has already been shown to be a big factor in fibromyalgia. And we know that a lot of the AV shunts of the arteriovenous shunts, mm-hmm. where you can regulate, do you want to have the warm blood go to the periphery or do you want it go back so you don't lose temperature? And that's how you do main, and that these AV shunts, which are the main temperature regulating valves in the skin and subcutaneous connective tissue, they are mostly in the superficial fascia membranous layer. So if you also have fibrosis there, and if you have a dysfunction of sympathetic nerve endings, so that would be also quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. That's given me a lot of food for thought for more superficial treatment of people with fibromyalgia. Because I find that it's, I think there's a lot of, I experience a lot of, like questionably diagnosed fibromyalgia because they don't know what else to call it. But with people who seem to have true fibromyalgia, their responses to treatment are not always consistent.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. that this to me suggests some new inroads there. So be curious to see how that continues to evolve in the future. I was, you know, it's funny you were talking about the stuff in between. I was at the Fascia Winter School in 2022, but it was online. And that was the thing that I missed the most was having the interactions in between and being able to discuss what we just saw or heard and what that might mean, which is the most valuable part of something like that. I'm hoping to get there next year, but I'll also be a few weeks away from deadline on another writing project.
We haven't discussed it yet.
I can't talk about it just yet.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I'm going to get there next year or not, but I really want to. I really want to.
Oh, yeah. You have been at the Ohm schools. You will love it. It's really nice.
I miss the Ohm schools. I miss the Ohm schools. Yeah. So what was the other? Can you talk about the other unpublished information, or was that it?
Yeah. Ah, unpublished. Let me see. There are two areas that go beyond manual and movement therapy. One was shockwave. They had talked about that before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they had shown that this, it's basically a mechanical impulse over a very short distance, but with a very high velocity.
I've had it done on my shoulder.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was developed to loosen kidney stones. And then they use the same technology to loosen trigger points or other densifications. And it has been successfully applied for several myofascial pain conditions. And they used that in a cell culture experiment where they showed that shockwave therapy stimulates the fibroblasts to develop within a few hours more hyaluronan, and that is now a very inspiring stimulation that the hyaluronan could be having an effect, you know, on how stiff the tissue is, but also on how pain-free you are, And so they don't think shockwave is better than a roughing elbow, but you can quantify it more exactly. So with elbow, you cannot so easily say, let's do 5% more and see what happens.
Right.
But with shockwave therapy, you can do that.
I also would think it can go some places that you can't always get.
Yeah.
With
yeah.
your elbow or other things. I'm also thinking about something Katarina Feda shared with me, which is that the fibroblasts, along with the fascocytes, fibroblasts can also produce hyaluronan.
Yeah.
But would you still have a hard time wrapping my head around? Or what are the conditions that allow that portable chemistry set we call the fibroblast to create hyaluronan instead of collagen? So maybe this might begin to explain that.
Yeah, well, I think you also interviewed Katarina. I love her.
Me too. She's great.
That smoking marijuana, so she wouldn't admit to that. But but the endocannabinoids.
Yes, yes.
They are a partial answer to your question.
Okay. we should call those the dude cells.
So. The endocannabinoids have been there probably in evolution before the cannabis plants came up. So they are not a new development. And there is a lot of research that the right endocannabinoid, CBD oil, etc., can have a pain inhibiting effect. And every smart ass, including me, thought it's purely a neurological, you know, it has a neurological function, which is apparently undebated, but maybe an additional function is not neurological, that the tissue environment around the nociceptive cells gets more softer. So that if you stimulate the endocannabinoids, your rigid connective tissue becomes a little bit more smooth and slippery, and then you can walk and you don't have pain anymore during the same movement. And maybe your headache improves because on the inside of the muscle, it's a little bit more smooth. And then the same nerve endings may be having the same chemistry, the same inflammatory milieu, but the brush which is around them is softer. and then they are not getting so...
That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense.
Vigorously stimulated. So I think this is a stimulating additional hypothesis, how endocannabinoids and shockwave therapy, etc., can influence the connective tissue to become a little bit more smoother by the hyaluronan that you have there. Where I was also challenged is what they call hydrodissection. And I visited that at a big fascia clinic in New Orleans, where they use
Tulane,
it.
Tulane University.
In Tulane University. And we have the most famous sports doctor in Germany, Müller Wohlfahrt, where Usain Bolt came and all the big ones. And he palpates them with closed eyes. Mm-hmm. He's very much a palpatory guy, Dr. Mm-hmm. Müller Wohlfahrt. But then he injects at least 30 syringes of his anti-inflammatory strange substance into it. And I kept thinking he could also inject just water and a saline elution into them, because it's probably several hundred milliliters that he puts into a thigh of one of these heroes that he is treating. So hydrodissection means you inject fluid in the right fascial compartment between two membranous layers where you want to spread them apart. And then it's basically a better suction method. So in cupping, you would pull on the skin, hoping that you are not
get
only
the
lifting
right place.
But you do a lifting from within by fluid ingestion.
Uh-huh. And, is this ultrasound or imaging guided?
Yeah, so yeah, you need to do that. So so you know you are at the right layer and you can see it's reaching there. And then you can discuss, so they have been discussing that they do it basically for the mechanical spreading effect, and that makes a lot of sense. So you have two layers adhered with each other, or you just want to do a mechanical stimulation where you create nano-micro injury irritation, that you have a pro-inflammatory healing response for day one and two that may then trigger an anti-inflammatory wound healing response on day 4, 5, 6, 7 or whatever, where you may then sedate a chronic silent inflammation that you had in the tissue since 12 weeks. So you start a new injury, micro injury, in order to have the fire brigade cool down the fire subsequently. So that is one strategy that is being discussed. And they are now discussing that you add, for example, hyaluronidase when you're doing hydrodissection at a tennis elbow, because then you think you have densification, where you don't have too much collagen, you have too much gluey, sticky hyaluronan that is like a cold, gluey honey. And then you want to change the honey and not the fibers. And then you would put some hyaluronidase, an enzyme that breaks down, not collagen, but breaks but down the sticky hyaluronan. And if you have fibrosis, like in frozen shoulder in Dupuytren, then you would not expect a big success by putting hyaluronidase into it, then you would possibly experiment with collagenase. But that is, of course, also careful, because they injected hyaluronidase in Dupuytren contracture, and it dissolved some of the tendons that you want to keep.
Oh, that's not good.
Yeah. So you better be careful in that. So I would just go with the fluid pressure and not mix any enzymes into it for now. But I think it's a provocative development. And probably we people who work with our hands, we will get more customers when the money-greedy MDs go into fascia therapy with their shockwave tools.
I think and, so, yes.
And
no, I see us very peacefully coexisting.
Yeah, yeah.
because sometimes it's good to have that shockwave to mm-hmm. break things up. I know someone who's had shockwave therapy post hip replacement, and yeah. it got that yeah. extra 10 or 15% that they really needed to get yeah. to for their mobility. It was able to do yeah. it in a way that other things could not. Yeah. So these, you know, I always go back to something Rochelle Clausen says, different things do different things. So we shouldn't yeah. expect that one thing yeah. can do everything, but the right combination of things can potentially do anything.
Yeah.
Don't quote me on that, listeners.
No, I will.
I'm just winging it. So we're coming up, old radio guy here. We're coming up to the top of the hour. Is there anything else you want to discuss before we sign off for today?
Yeah, my lecture, of course, was
of course.
For me the very best.
The yes, the so last, how can but you certainly ignore, not least.
Robert, what about your lecture? No, that was very nice because I had done a similar lecture in the year before. So I focused on repeating some of the contents, but also adding some of them. And they gave me lots of support for it because mm-hmm. I was daring to link back to where I had started my academic career, not 100 years ago, but almost 100 years ago as a young student. So when I studied psychology at the university, and then I came into connective tissue and morphing, etc. And now I'm working together with some psychological researchers on depression. And I shared the latest research, mm-hmm. and there was also lots of interest in it. So in depressive patients, we found an increased myofascial stiffness. So we have now some measurement tools, which are basically palpating fingers made out of machines to see how stiff is the myofascial tissue on the neck. And they are quite stiff there, the myo. And but at the same time, they are not only stiffer, they also have a more dampening and less elastic recoil. And you know that if you have one shoulder that is healthy and the other is pathological, or one arm, the healthy and the younger tissue bounces back more quickly. So it has more elastic recoil. And if you push into the pathological tissue, it takes a second or longer until the dimple comes back. So it's not as elastic. So we also found in this research that depressive people, they are not only stiffer, they also have less elastic recoil there. And that was quite stimulating.
They have less capacity to bounce back.
Yeah, to bounce back. So mm-hmm. it may be related to a body armoring. Because normally, if a tissue gets stiffer, it has more bouncing back quality. If it's the same stiffness, if you have a rubber mm-hmm. band and you make it tighter, you bounce further back,
right?
etc. So it's first description where the same tissue, if it's the same tissue, gets stiffer, but it has less recoil capacity. So it seems to be changing into a different tissue, like a rubber band changing over into a sandbag or something like that. It could be related with inflammatory changes. So that is what my friend Werner Klingler is suspecting in relationship. But they also showed in the same study group there, if the depressive patients go on a foam roller and do foam rolling of their neck and of their middle back, their memory recall is significantly better. And memory recall is a highly reliable method mm-hmm. how the filter of their brain is working. So you read a list of many words to them. Half of them are positive and negative. The other half is negative. Mm-hmm. Then you stop for a minute and then you read another list. And on the second list, you ask with each word, have you heard that word before a minute ago?
Okay.
And the depressive patients remember every negative word, even if you only have it heard once. But sure. The positive word, no, I never heard it. And you said it 5 times before. Mm-hmm. So that explains if you are together with a depressive friends, you can make up the best healing stories. You can read poetry. You can give them positive for 5 hours. Mm-hmm. But you could also stop doing it because they will not hear it. Or you could tell them in gibberish or whatever. They yeah. will not, it will not reach them.
Well, that's a whole neurological thing too, where we pick out the things
yeah.
that sound like us. Like I've yeah. seen somebody do that with experiment in a horoscope, where they ask a room full of people, "I'm going to read a horoscope, and you tell me if you think that's your sign or not." And what they find is people, they get it wrong all the time, and it's not. It has nothing to do with their sign. It's just whatever you resonate to that's in that statement that's what sticks in your brain.
Yeah.
And the other stuff, not so much. So yeah. when they did foam rolling.
So after foam rolling.
They had better recall.
Yeah. They suddenly said, I heard this positive word before. And that means it's a real structural change that they have. Because they use this memory recall. It's a very established test. Mm-hmm. To determine whether you need to continue your pharmacological treatment for 3 more weeks, or if you can stop going to a lower dosage. You also, if you do behavioral therapy with depressive patients, you do that test to say you need to continue it. We can go to another therapy now, because now you can hear what I'm saying. You know, you can look at a flower and say, aha, I see something positive. But if that filter is there, it doesn't make sense to look at flower.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. Yeah.
So if you have depressive patients, have them go on a foam roller.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then you do behavioral therapy or whatever it is with them. And the test was actually quite nicely done, because they had a control group where they did a very similar treatment. So they also lifted their head and put it down with all the head weight, but they didn't roll. They only did vertical placement and vertical lifting, similar like you do on the foam roll. So the stabilization is very similar, but you don't have that paying attention. So my explanation, and I'm not sure, is that the rumination is interrupted. We know that depressive patients, they cannot stop talking to themselves. And they are obsessive people, so it's called default mode network. So when you're daydreaming, when you're not paying attention to your beloved talking to you or whatever, and you are communicating within your own brain, that is a compulsive feature in depressive patients. And when you're foam rolling, you need to pay at least 60% of your attention to how you calibrate the rolling, that you don't slip down and that it doesn't become too painful. So maybe it's this focused attention that you have in the rolling that you don't have if you only lift your head for 3 seconds and put it down at a monotonous cycle. Mm-hmm. So that is my speculation, that if you give clear fascial stimulation, and our group has shown that fascia is our richest sensory organ, that we have 250 million nerve endings. So how can you stimulate the nervous system with stimulation from the environment? And foam rolling could be ideal, or stretching. But if you do it with a here and now investigative somanautic participation, where you're not daydreaming while you're rolling or doing
it. You're in a situation where you have to pay attention to a different kind of stimuli.
So I found that actually quite nice in the depressive patients. And there was also the researcher I shared that he had looked back at, you know, the research by Amy Cuddy on power posing.
Yes, power posing and
And that was a big crisis in psychology studies, because Amy Cuddy is a superstar outside of academic circles.
Right.
Her TED Talk is number two of the whole world history of any TED Talk. And she has sold her book a million times, and it's actually moving what she does. But as a scientist, she failed because
yes.
she had to acknowledge that her statistics were not state of the art. She should have controlled it. She should have been more anal in controlling her assistant and doing double checks, what are exclusion criteria, etc. She had a little bit more of self-fulfilling prophecy, which you can eagerly do as a doctorate student, but as a professor, she should have been more rigid. And she had to step down, etc. Because when they repeated her studies, and that started the whole replication crisis, which shook every academic department in psychology worldwide, meaning that most of the studies that we all love, if you replicate them in psychology, 60% of them don't work anymore. And so since that, and Amy Cuddy was kind of the famous person who was sacrificed for that purpose. And if you study psychology today, you will hear Amy Cuddy as an example. Don't follow her. You will be a hero outside of the academic world, but if you come back to your peers, they will say you didn't do it very well. So she had shown that you have psychological improvement, but also that your testosterone would be higher if you have expansive posture. But that didn't work. If you replicate it without a bias in the design, and she had really to apologize and say yes, the because they had replicated her research with much better controls and higher numbers. And there were no hormonal changes associated with posture. So everybody agrees now, 3 minutes of power posing does not change your testosterone, but does it change your perception? You know, how you think about other people, how funny or not a comic is that you look at, and how you look at the value of yourself and other people in the world. And now they did a meta study. Does posture influence your emotional behavior and your perception? And that was finally evaluated. And the answer is yes. But with a surprise, it's the contractive posture. If you make yourself a little bit smaller, they have a very profound effect. And they shape your perception and your emotion very dramatically. But if you go in the positive improvement, that has only little effect. So posture influences us. Very fascinating. So I would have to call back all my hundreds and thousands of Rolfing clients who I did Rolfing movement. And I say, use your mindful attention to focus on the effect, what happens if you stand a bit more upright, if you stand more relaxed, if you make yourself less contractive. And yes, that works according to that meta study, but not very potently. It would be much more valuable that I say, study what happens when you make yourself smaller, when you get your shoulders forward, and how that changes your thinking and your feeling, so that when it happens next time, you are sensitized for it. And that was a surprise. So if you get that meta study, it was published last year.
Okay.
And my professor so it's very, so if you know it, and for me, it was a surprise. So there is a strong link from the body to emotions and perception and the brain. But the link seems to be stronger for negative influences than for positive ones. And maybe that's based on how learning and conditioning happens. For survival, negative experiences, they stick longer, which is not nice for your happiness in life. So if you have a bad experience with a friend and a good one, the bad one you will unfortunately remember for the next 20 years.
But you know, that's how social media works. They know that negative engagement gets more attention than positive thoughts. because it sticks in there. And
it sticks. You know? So negative things stick. And of course, for survival.
Like sticky hyaluronan.
Yeah. So for survival, it has an advantage, but it's not nice.
Yeah, it's not the best social glue. Yeah.
So, but for us, movement teacher, I think it's very valuable that you do like Ron Kurtz did. You do voluntary exaggerations like we used to do in roughing movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you put people on the tuning board and you do a little irritation, earthquake number 0.5, you wiggle and you see what you do for protection. And some people straighten their knees, some I swallow in my tongue. So tiny contractive postures that are not very negative. And you look at them through a magnifying glass and see, what are you doing with your little finger, Robert, here? Can you do it voluntarily? Does it feel familiar? Is there another gesture that wants to go along with it? And then you realize, I've been doing that since childhood. And then Hubert Godard comes and talks about frozen gestures mm-hmm. as a tiny thing you can study. So I think this has a lot of clinical implication that we, of course, we study how wonderful it is if I open up and if I relax and if I breathe fuller, but it will not have such a long-lasting therapeutic effect. But if I study through a friendly magnifying glass, what happens when I make myself smaller? So that I can recognize it more easily, can stop it, can decide not to do it, can smile over it and let my shoulder relax, that may have more profound effects.
Yeah. Well, you know, in my practice, people want homework. I give homework and I always give a piece what I call Zen homework. So mm-hmm. usually there's one area in not every session, but most sessions, there's one area in particular that needs a little more mindfulness appeared to it. So mm-hmm. I always tell them the next time you feel something in that area that you don't like, that's not what you're feeling right now, but when you're feeling mm-hmm. it, like why you came in, stop for a moment as much as you can and observe what you're doing, how you're doing it, who you're doing it with, whatever mm-hmm. the environmental conditions around that moment. In your biomechanical conditions and see if you can begin to see some sort of pattern and come back in mm-hmm. and give me that information. So mm-hmm. that's I think you're telling me I've already been applying this.
As if you had read the study before it was published.
Oh, stop it. But thank you. I now have scientific backing for my Zen homework. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Robert, it's been delightful to catch up with you today.
Same for me.
It has been for the listeners too. We'll do it again soon. Take care.
Yes, and see you next time at the summer school, at the winter school.
I hope so. I hope so. Hey, everybody, thank you for listening again to another installation of the Body Talk podcast. We live in an attention economy, and if you give me your attention, I will always make sure it's worth your time. Feel free to drop me a line at bodytalkdavid@gmail.com. You can find me on the social platforms as well. Also at patreon.com/bodytalkradio if you want to help support this podcast. It's deeply, deeply appreciated. This is David Lasondak saying see you next time here on Body Talk, where we explore your inner universe.